Joe, how you doing?
Well, pretty good, Tim. I'm here doing poppers and disco music. hope I don't get AIDS.
Okay, down
the, that is one of the worst introductions to a topic I've ever come up with. But yeah, we were going to talk about AIDS, HIV, and it's an enormously important medical issue, but also it's an important cultural issue. Wouldn't you say, Tim, can you give us, some background in it and your opinions about it?
Well, let's see here. HIV AIDS. Now, this is the kind of standard narrative because I pulled it out of Wikipedia. HIV AIDS, the human immunodeficiency virus infection and acquired immune deficiency syndrome, is a spectrum of conditions caused by infection with the human immunodeficiency virus, HIV. Following initial infection, a person may not notice any symptoms or may experience a brief period of influenza-like illness. Typically, this is followed by a prolonged period with no symptoms, maybe years. As the infection progresses, it interferes with the immune system, increasing the risk of developing common infections such as tuberculosis, as well as other opportunistic infections and tumors that rarely affect people who have working immune systems. These late symptoms of infection are referred to as acquired immunodeficiency syndrome, AIDS. This stage is often associated with unintended weight loss. HIV is spread primarily by unprotected sex, including anal and oral sex, contaminated blood transfusions, hypodermic needles, and from mother to child during pregnancy, delivery, or breastfeeding. Let's see what else they have here. I lost my place. Yes, some bodily fluids such as saliva and tears do not transmit AIDS. Methods of prevention include safe sex, okay, needle exchange programs, treating those who are infected, and male circumcision prevents AIDS. Ken, that's interesting. They push that. Disease in a baby can often be prevented by giving both the mother and child antiretroviral medication. So we're drugging babies. There is no cure or vaccine, however. Antiviral treatments can slow the course of the disease and may lead to near normal life expectancy. Treatment is recommended as soon as the diagnosis is made. Without treatment, the average survival time after infection is 11 years. In 2016, about 36.7 million people were living with HIV, and it resulted in 1 million deaths. These were 300,000 fewer. I'm sorry, there were 300,000 fewer newer HIV cases in 2016 than in 2015. Most of those infected live in the sub-Saharan Africa. I don't think they get any effective diagnosis in Africa. That's funny. But from the time AIDS was identified in the early 1980s to 2017, the disease has caused an estimated 35 million deaths worldwide. HIV-AIDS is considered a pandemic, a disease outbreak which is present over a large area and is actively spreading. AIDS originated in West Central Africa during the late 19th and early 20th century. AIDS was first recognized by the United States Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in 1981, and its cause is HIV infection was identified in the early part of the decade. So, that's the official narrative, and most of that, from what I can tell, is bunk. So, that's what we have. AIDS around the world is not one condition. It's a variety dead and health situations in various groups where immune suppression is caused by different factors such as medical drugs, starvation, syphilis, tropical disease, contaminated water, and hopelessness and misery. That's the hardest thing to get the people to see. AIDS has never been proved to be one condition. The so-called AIDS virus, HIV, has never been proven to cause any human disease. That's written by John Rappaport. So, that's kind of like what we're talking about tonight. So so what do you have to say about HIV/AIDS and that sort of brief history of the standard narrative and John Rappaport's comments?
Well, I would agree with Rappaport and just assert as a fact that no one has ever shown clear causality between the HIV virus and the disease known as AIDS. It just there isn't any scientific paper that can be cited. It's interesting, but the Nobel laureate Kary Mullis, he actually invented what's known as PCR, which is the way that DNA can be replicated massively so that you can actually see then, what strands of DNA are active at what time, because it's obviously, if you're trying to look at a particular DNA strand, it's basically impossible. But if you can replicate it a billion times, then you can have enough of it to get a snapshot of it. Well, anyway, Mullis, he was going to write a paper to the NIH where he was going to try to get some interest in his work to develop a test for HIV. And so he said, well, I need to have a citation for the causality between HIV and AIDS. And he says there wasn't any. Said zero. He looked for 2 years, he said, and he was just fascinated and amazed, by this. And so you wonder, well, why in the world, if there wasn't an actual scientific causality, did it become such a popular media phenomenon, right? I mean, I'm absolutely positive that Mullis is correct. Okay, I actually kind of did some research into what he had been trying to come up with, and I can absolutely guarantee you that just at that time there hadn't ever been any causality demonstrated. Okay, so it becomes now a question of, well, why is the media a presentation of AIDS becoming so vivid, so dramatic, when there isn't a actual disease that can be related to it? And so my take on AIDS is that what you had was the sexual revolution of the late 60s and 70s, right? Which is to say the Freemason crypto attack upon Western civilization.
Yeah, Freemasonry and free love, right?
Right, whereby they would just encourage all kinds of sexual debasement and no family production. Okay, so that's just a general way I have of understanding it. But what this led to, of course, was not just the hippies fornicating in the mud at Woodstock, but this basically became the moral platform for nightclubs, right, in the inner city and suburbs in the 70s. And this is where started having this problem in terms of the actual natural consequences of a debased lifestyle.
Yeah, like what was going on at the Stonewall nightclub in New York in 1969.
Exactly. You see, when the moral stopper was pulled off the bottle of human sexuality, it unleashed not just sort of sensual experience, but also microbes.
Yeah.
And what you had, particularly in among gay men, and I, you'd have to actually, do kind of sociologic studies to determine why they were they went to such extreme debasement, but they did. And I think I mentioned once before that I saw a study for risk for HIV that was done in San Francisco. And it used as the median, in other words, it divided the groups into two halves in terms of the sexual activity. And the median was 300 sex partners a year. So that meant that over half the people had more. Now, I mean, this is basically a full-time job, you know. So what's happening is that you had completely revolutionary behavior. I mean, I don't think you had that, you know, in the 1930s in the United States or in Europe, you had many people who had 600 sex partners in a year. I think this would just be completely extraordinary.
Yeah, and also
But
what they're doing to maintain that pace, they're taking all types of stimulants and drugs, which more or less burn the body out.
well, exactly right. So you're increasing the amount of microbes you're being exposed to, and you're at the same time, the drug that was really doing the damage, in my opinion, was amyl nitrate or butyl nitrate. There are different versions of it, but they're all called poppers.
Yeah.
And I guess we're going to talk about, you know, we're going to talk about subjects which can be called adults. So if there are
Yeah.
children listening, parents, and I would suggest getting them out of there because you know, I don't know how to discuss this subject with, you know, in fact, and you know, if you don't go into these areas. And so I'll try to do as carefully as I can, but I would really suggest that parents do not permit children to listen to the rest of, you know, some of the stuff. It's just inappropriate. It's not age appropriate. But amyl nitrates were popular. That because they facilitated anal intercourse, they relax the sphincter and deaden the sense of pain.
Yeah,
Okay, so
originally wasn't it for people with angina pain?
it was for heart
Yeah,
attacks. Yeah,
yeah,
that's what it
yeah.
became sold as, was basically if you had angina, it could reduce the symptoms and also it could increase circulation, blood flow, so that you know the heart muscle could. You know, I was like they would sometimes use nitroglycerin, I believe, or you know other kind of really
Yeah.
profound stimulants. You know, just move the blood around so the heart could pump, and so this is what it was used for. But then it was found that it was a sex aid for gay men, and this became an epidemic. You know, at gay discotheques. You know, the inhabitants were seen just kind of shuffling around in a daze, holding poppers. These are the bottles with amyl nitrate under their nose, giving it to their companions. One person wrote that the miasma of nitrate fumes was taken for granted at gay gathering places, bars, baths, leather clubs. And it says that some gay men were never without their bottle, from which they sorted fumes around the clock. And then there were two separate studies done in the 70s found that gay men weren't able to perform sexually if they didn't have poppers, right? So this is how entwined amyl nitrate became with the behavior. And so what you have is experimental behavior, and I'm just talking about hundreds and hundreds of sex partners, right? Having anal sex, which is obviously a different, you know, physical act from the perspective of body defenses, right? Because the anus is not similar to the vagina in terms of being able to resist, you know, bacteria and virus. Okay, it's a very weak membrane. And so you had this experimental behavior in terms of the amount of microbes that you're being exposed to. And at the same time, you're taking a drug, amyl nitrate, which damages the immune system. And so the first thing that you can see is that regular, you know, well-known and researched sexually transmitted diseases went through the roof in the gay community. This was long before the AIDS epidemic started. So you have syphilis and gonorrhea just through the roof. I mean, I don't have the statistics in front of me, but I mean, it's like in the order of like thousands of times beyond the baseline populations. I mean, literally everyone in this environment had these diseases. And again, you know, you're combining now diseases with chemicals and a debased lifestyle. And so the next phase of the thing was then suddenly you had a lot of gay men appearing with a kind of cancer. And this was Kaposi's sarcoma. And basically it was then later determined, long after HIV had been linked to AIDS, that Kaposi's sarcoma is a kind of cancer that is basically produced by relationships to paupers, that amyl nitrate was found to be something that could bring it about. And so the thing that I, okay, so that's kind of just a background, solid, not solid, but it's just a description of what physically happened, and why you can clearly see that the causality between HIV and AIDS is weak, because it seems to ignore these more obvious, connections, the ones between lifestyle.
Yeah, Joe, to address that particular point you're making here, Dr. Nancy Turner Banks, her book AIDS, Opium, and Empire, she talks about this whole idea of AIDS, HIV/AIDS, and she writes, if you bear with me, the defining phrase that allowed the entire AIDS system to be set up as it has been, was the claim that the men presented with these illnesses had no known cause for diminished resistance to the diseases. Were they kidding? A reading of the early cases reveal that most of the men had, for almost 10 years or more, been using massive amounts of drugs, including poppers, antibiotics, cocaine, and heroin, and had been chronically ingesting a range of prophylactic antibiotics to ward off the numerous sexually transmitted diseases they were prone to. Had the recurrent sexually transmitted diseases, including viral hepatitis, had multiple partners in a single night, had engaged in sexual activity fit for the Marquis de Sade, and had often been exhausted, stressed out, and malnourished. The CDC then stated that they had no known cause for the defect in the cell-mediated immunity. What planet were these people living on? So I thought that was a good...
Yeah, well, it sums it up a lot better than I did.
Yeah,
I mean, it just makes no sense at all. So it begs the question, is like, well, what in the heck is going on? AIDS became, just the most common news story, in the 80s. It was just everywhere. And it was always related as about to break out into the heterosexual community, right? We're all sharing the threat, it's this unification, multiculturalism, where
Magic Johnson has AIDS.
Yeah, that's right. Well, particularly when Magic Johnson got AIDS, that was the first indicator. Okay, so now the heterosexuals are going to be dropping like flies. Everyone believed it. I did. I had no reason to doubt it. It just was overwhelming propaganda. And so, in hindsight, it begs the question, well, why did they do this? Why did they terrify the public? And you see, it really does beg the question, because obviously the lifestyle was the problem. And by positing a bug as the cause, people wouldn't change their lifestyle.
Yeah, yeah.
It's okay to take poppers, but just make sure that your 50 sex partners this month don't have AIDS.
And just bad luck.
So, right. And I actually knew a gay couple, and I was you know, at a kind of, they lived near me, and I would see them, and I was like hanging out one day with them, and one of them said to the other, it says, don't forget to take your pills. And, you know, this was before AIDS had really gotten, you know, powerful, but I didn't, you know, so I asked him, I said, what pills are you talking about? He goes, well, like antibiotics. And I would say, are you sick? And he said, no, he says, I take them so I don't get sick. In other words,
jeez.
What they were doing is they were getting antibiotics because they knew they would get syphilis and gonorrhea from their social activity. And so they were basically preempting it, or they thought they could, by just constantly being on antibiotics. Now, when you're on antibiotics, you're wiping out your immune system, and your, you know, your biome is getting damaged, right? But they actually thought that they could ward off disease by constantly taking antibiotics. That's you know, that actually happened. That's something I experienced. And in hindsight, it's just, you know, chilling that here you have a whole community that's been basically misled, misinformed. And, you know, it goes straight back to, you know, the authoritarian personality, and right back to, you know, Gregor Loukos, or however you pronounce his last name, because they had attempted to insert sexual debasement into culture consistently for, you know, close to 100 years, for 80 years. And so when you get to Eros and Civilization, Marcuse's book, he talks about polysexualism. He talks about just sex as recreation. And he also actually talks about, you know, this, there is this obsession with hygiene that is a remnant of bourgeois, you know, authoritarian lifestyle. So you can be more relaxed, you know, more, you know, hanging out with your friends like at Woodstock, you know, where you're fornicating strangers in the mud. And so that was what was given to us culturally. And then, you know, this is only 15 years, 10 years later, basically. You now have, you know, the, like in the San Francisco and New York, you have a whole culture that is basically involved in self-destruction. And so that's, you know, what you're looking at when you look at the bathhouse and the disco culture scene of like the late 70s and 80s. You're looking at the kind of the manifestation of the ideas that were inserted into culture by the cultural Marxists, you know, in the 60s.
Yeah. I mean, it's fairly, it should have been fairly obvious to anyone in the medical profession, anyone with a rudimentary understanding of medicine and health, that when someone comes in with a chronic illness and they're suffering sort of this collapse of their immune system, that you might ask them, so what do you do at night? What are you eating? What are you doing? And obviously the patient had been honest with them that, you know, I have six sex partners a night. It's not natural sex, actually. It's homosexual sex. So it, and I'm taking all these antibiotics. I'm staying up late at night. I'm doing a lot of these drugs. I'm just not eating well. I'm eating out a lot. You know, no one's at home to cook for me. You know, but instead they just push pills on them. It exposes either the incompetence or the malevolence of the medical community.
Yeah, absolutely. It clearly shows that. It shows that at a high level, the medical community is in on the deal. They're part of the genocide.
They push the fear because, yeah. I mean, these are the people you go to, the men in white coats, the experts in the big buildings and, you know, the big salaries. And, you know, as lay people, we're going to look for them for some sort of guidance in these things. And when they expose themselves, or at least they're exposed as being completely malevolent, you really have to start to rethink the entire program. And that's what AIDS kind of reveals, is the dishonesty and malevolence of the system. Now, obviously, AIDS, if it was HIV, these things, I suppose, a lifestyle, things, obviously you could reverse the condition and improve people's health by, you know, by detoxifying, cleansing these things. And indeed, those who did that did get better. And the homosexual men who were a bit more who were more restrained, who lived healthier lives and didn't take AZT, lived, and the ones who took AZT died. And that's, and AZT is the story of AZT. This, I guess it was a chemotherapy drug developed in the 1960s, which was originally shelved as being too deadly. The HIV/AIDS narrative hypothesis created a market for AZT, which was then marketed, and it was in itself was deadly. It was a DNA chain breaker. And what they made it to make it look less deadly, they actually added sulfur to it. And what they found out was a lot of these patients dying of AIDS, they had didn't have enough sulfur in their system, and the AZT was actually getting rid of it. In order to make AZT look better, they actually added sulfur to it, from what I understand, to make it less deadly, to make it look like it was more effective. That's how perverse the system was.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. It is. Well, AZT is just one of my, you know, favorite drugs. Love to take it. I take it all the time. I'm kidding. AZT is just a direct descendant of chemotherapy, which comes from, of course, all chemotherapy was developed from mustard gas.
Yeah, doesn't it's funny how modern medicines derive from chemical warfare?
You know, it's funny, but unfortunately, it's very clear as to why that is.
Yeah, AZT, apparently, what I understand, it's a toxin that's pulled out of salmon sperm. And then weaponized, and then they turn it into a medicine. That's at least how I understand its origins. It's a toxin that they found in salmon sperm.
It's a toxin. It's molecularly related to. They were looking. Basically, they've been looking for more chemotherapies, and so they know the basic, you know, structure of chemotherapy, and they look in different places to see if they can find something similar, and then they test and find out what the results are. But all chemotherapy operates the same way, at least in terms of cancer prevention, cure, so-called. They know it'll kill you, but they hope it'll kill the cancer first.
Yeah, yeah, it's sort of like a war of attrition.
And
they only give it to a short thing about chemotherapy, at least, is when I stand it, the standard of care is you only give it to patients for a short period of time. AZT was a long,
it was a lifetime.
It was down to be deadly. Yeah, exactly. So even under like the normal.
As long as you lived, which is only a few years.
But then probably. You die, they blame AIDS.
Of course. So. You become another part of the AIDS epidemic. After you get wiped out by amyl nitrate and then AZT. I mean, they're just killing, you know, tens of thousands of people with this process.
And you also, and if you look at the patterns of the disease itself, it didn't follow normal, you know, epidemics. It never got out of the gay ghetto. It only struck people who were either immunodeficient, weakened, or, these people, you know, living this fast-track gay lifestyle. Homosexual men who weren't living the fast-track gay lifestyle weren't coming down with AIDS. Prostitutes who weren't drug users weren't coming down with AIDS. It was prostitutes who were intravenous drug users who were coming down with AIDS, you know. So it was clear. I mean, it's so obvious that, again, one can only think it's malevolence at this point.
Yeah, of course. And that's the thing is that you were too young, but I lived through all this very vividly. And it was, you know, basically it was, trauma-based mind control. You were... The heterosexual community, you know, it was like you had this cloud over it. It was about to break out. There were, you know, there'd be story after story about how the geometry of the spread of AIDS in the heterosexual community was about to begin. And by 1995, they anticipated like 60% of the population. And, in hindsight, it's actually kind of tragicomic. Because it never broke out into the heterosexual community whatsoever. In fact, I don't think there's ever been an actual case. The HIV virus, the retroviruses don't. I'm kind of over my pay grade, but they're so complicated. I mean, retrograde viruses like HIV are barely living things, right? They're sort of half dead. That's why they can exist for such a long time without, producing a response from the immune system.
And they're not pathogenic, from what I understand.
No, they typically are not, unless you combine other factors to them, which eventually was even admitted by Gallo after, you know, that when the disease didn't break out into the heterosexual community, when they were never able to produce any kind of reasonable causality empirically. Gala, who with the French guy Montagnier, both claimed that they had both discovered the virus and the causality. Gallo had to basically publicly back away from that and say, well, it's in combinations with other things.
This goes back to the war on cancer, when they tried to find a viral-based origin for cancer, where they thought cancer might be a disease, an infectious disease. And what's interesting about that is the infectious disease paradigm is a 19th century paradigm, which we're still going by, where really you could argue that perhaps in the 19th century that much of the problem was an infectious disease problem, but was cured by better diet and better public sanitation and these things. But in the 20th century, it's not microbes that's really, at least the latter half of the 20th century, the broad health problems that the modern world is dealing with today isn't infectious disease. It's systemic toxicity. Yeah, toxicity.
Capital toxicity from poisons that the oligarchs are putting into our environment.
Yeah, which is everything. I mean, it's...
Yeah. 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 But so anyway, I was just going to point out that, you know, the there is this question of, well, why did the oligarchs then decide to take this AIDS meme? You know, there were all these gay men who were getting sick, they were getting Kaposi's, and then suddenly you had story after story about, you know, HIV is a virus, Gallo discovered it, then you had the heterosexual community was bound to start having the same geometry, and you were going to end up with two-thirds of the population, you know, wiped out. Well, you know, like, why would they do this? Well, I would just say it was done as kind of the trauma-based mind control. In other words, you know, they're always basically trying to shatter the souls of the inhabitants.
Yeah, it's duck and cover applied to medicine. Yeah.
Exactly. And so we had, if you think about the boomer, we spent our childhood underneath, our desk waiting for the nuclear bomb. When we got out from under the desk, they drafted us and sent us off to Vietnam, where, you know, we were in the jungle being shot at and blown up. And then we came back in just in time for Woodstock so we could take LSD. And then, you know, the next thing you know, very next thing is you've got, I'm sorry, you can't have, this free love thing is going to be a problem because here comes AIDS. And I'm going to just, you know, create a little theory about it. I can't prove this, but, you know, Tim, we can show that we are under attack, that the democratic process is a fraud, that the oligarchs control both sides of it, and they obviously control the media. And what we see as history and news are, in fact, propaganda techniques to basically soften us up for genocide and for slavery, I think, in the interim. So how does AIDS fit into that? This would be the way I would try to understand it. And I would just, say that AIDS was a zombie film. You know, it was the zombie from the gay disco that was going to come out into the middle class and bite you. And then you would become a zombie yourself, you know. So that's how I think... the Kaposi sarcoma phenomena that had broken out into, you know, in the gay communities was then seized upon. They said, well, what the heck, how to use this in the right way. And the next thing you know, they were claiming that there was an epidemic, even though it was clear. I mean, it must have been clear to them. See, this is what I would posit. It had to have been clear to them that this was lifestyle. I mean, Tim, they created the lifestyle. Right. They would know what the lifestyle was that was going on in the gay bathhouse. They created all that in, you know, with the Cultural Revolution and the sex, drugs and rock and roll. They understood the sex and drugs that were going on in these places. And they certainly knew that debasement, physical as well as moral, was taking place. So when suddenly you have this Kaposi's pop up, I mean, they would go, oh, my gosh, there must be a virus in there. That's preposterous. They must have known that when this popped up, that this was related to the lifestyle. And I'll just go even further, as long as I'm just speculating. The thing about Kaposi sarcoma that is so would have been so fascinating to the oligarchs is that it is the most physically deforming cancer imaginable. It attacks the face. You get these black splotches. It's very zombie-like. And you waste away. If you look at the whole genre of zombie films, you know, and there's like 1,000 of them because this is a theme that the oligarchs love to terrorize the population with. They look like Kaposi sarcoma victims staggering out of the disco. You know, that's what they look like. So, you know, I mean, this is a speculation, but I think it's one that, you know, is reasonable that this is what was interesting to them is that it just created another wave of terror to, you know, have the population be beaten down a little bit more. And of course, what was the response where we're looking for a vaccination, right? We're looking for scientism to save us. I mean, this is how crazy the world is that here you had something that was just so obviously behaviorally driven, right? I mean, these guys in the bathhouses and the gay discos were engaged in behavior. I mean, Nero couldn't even imagine a lifestyle like these guys, you know? And so the idea they say, well, it's got to be a virus. This is just ridiculous. It's just not even a sensible idea. So, you know, the way to understand it is that they understood very well that this was, you know, that the cancer that was getting, you know, produced was something that was coming from, you know, the combination of lifestyle, massive doses of microbes and chemicals. And because it deforms the face and the, you know, and the wasting away, they created a zombie. Right. This is an individual who can spread the disease, just like in the zombie films.
Yeah, you had the narrative of Patient Zero, the French Canadian airline flight attendant or something.
Exactly.
And narratives, the monkey in Africa.
Look at there was one that that annoying. What's that guy's name? Brad Pitts, that little twit. He had this movie called Z Nation.
I saw it.
I mean, someone showed it to me. I have Netflix, so I watched it. And they have a patient zero there too, mm-hmm. right? And you know, they have these people coming back from the dead, but they look pretty much like, you know, you put a, you know, spandex pants on them, and they could make a play in the gay disco. So there it is. You know, I mean, it's a way of understanding it, and it's a way of understanding it in the context of the world that we have revealed. You know, that this was what was really attractive about it to the oligarchs is that it created a zombie to terrorize people, and it did actually work. And see, what you do is then you look to the government. You know, where's my vaccination so I can get back to the disco, so I can go back to my life, so I don't get bitten by a zombie. It makes the population more impotent, you know. And if you just look at, if you trace how this fit into the whole pattern of the boomer, you know, who grows up under his desk with the duck and cover waiting for the bomb to hit him, you know, off to Vietnam, you know, this Woodstock and all of this trauma. And now you have the AIDS thing. It's just one weak story after another, but they're all designed for the same thing. They're just trying to make you impotent, make you have to relate to government and say, oh, please help me. I don't want the zombie to come out of the disco and bite me.
Yeah, and also what you have here is a broader cover-up is sort of is a John Rappaport has a thing called where the virus is the fall guy, so the cover-up. More. Yeah, the virus is the cover-up because a lot of these things, whether it's Zika, AIDS, even in many respects cancer, is you're dealing with issues of toxicity and oxidative stress where the cells aren't functioning properly because the mitochondria isn't getting enough oxygen, so it doesn't produce enough ATP, and so your cells start to misbehave or not function properly. But you know, like with Zika, where you know they're spraying chemicals, there's industrial operations going on there. The water's polluted, the people are malnourished, and these things. But they blame a mosquito. Of course, the solution is either a genetically modified mosquito, courtesy Bill Gates, or a shot in the arm. You know, and the same thing with you know broad thing with cancer is you're dealing with multi-factors. Multi-factor disease, but itself, but cancer itself is a symptom, and it isn't really the disease itself. It's the symptom of cells going haywire. What's causing the cells to go haywire? Well, with that, you start to have to sort of reevaluate everything. I mean, perhaps the you know the industrial modern lifestyle, or parts of it at least, maybe how we live. Maybe we should look at industrialized farming, where food is vegetables and fruit are picked, or fruit is picked before it's ripe, then it's sprayed to look ripe, and then it's shipped to, you know, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 miles away. It's chemically treated to grow faster, but doesn't have the nutrients. You have, you know, industrial farming with animals where they're forced to live in bins in their own excrement, so they're pumped full of antibiotics and other drugs. And so this supposedly is to make food cheaper. So everyone is not getting enough nutrition. They're being poisoned through the chemicals and processed food. Even the airwaves are poisoned with electromagnetic activity with cell phones and cell towers and wireless this, wireless that. People are just overwhelmed, and there's no discussion about maybe rolling that back. In fact, they're upping it up to 5G. You know,
yeah.
And it's the impulse rate that really makes the difference. That's going to jumble your cells faster, and it's going to make it harder for them to repair. Not getting enough sleep, these things where, you know, sleep is when your cells start to rest and they repair. So it's the restless lifestyle, but no one's addressing that. They think the cure is it's a virus, it's a drug, or you're just it's genetic. You have genetic predisposition to this, so let's cut your breast off now before you get cancer. Let's cut off healthy tissue. Terrifying people. Instead of addressing all these other causes. And, you know, I feel sorry for someone who's I know people who've been diagnosed with late stage cancer, and they're struck with this radical position where they have to accept this war of attrition with chemotherapy because they're facing death and these things. I understand why they make that decision, because it's such a difficult position to be in. You would just want to live another 5 years in these things. But the bottom line is the medical community is devoting all these resources into chemical warfare, you know, into radiation treatment, and they're saying nothing about the poisonous and toxic environment that the modern world, that these companies are creating for us, that create these diseases in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. This is the whole problem, and this is why the HIV, at this point, obvious fraud, I think is a really valuable piece of information to people, for people to be aware of, is that, you know, if you go back, and I would ask people who are, you know, wanting to get a really clear picture about all this is just go back and look at newspaper articles in the 80s when AIDS was first onsetting, and just read the newspaper articles for about 5 years, and you can see how they were absolutely not only certain, but they were disclosing to the public, you know, that the heterosexual community was going to be attacked by this virus. That the disco zombie was going to get out into the middle class.
You know, why were they saying that?
Yeah, why were they saying that? But but they were saying, don't worry, we're working on a vaccination.
Yeah, they said in 2 years, I think in 1984.
In 84, they came out, they're saying, well, we're going to have a vaccination pretty soon. You'll be lining up around the block to get your vaccination. And then they came up with drugs. Now, when Magic Johnson supposedly came down with it, they started giving him this whole cocktail of stuff. Mm-hmm. Because when you give people AZT, you have to give them other chemicals to neutralize the effect of the AZT.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you'll die. So it's called a cocktail, right? It isn't just AZT. You get about, like, I don't know, 10 drugs or something, you know. And, you know, it really debilitates, you know, most people. I think Johnson was actually, he was pretty athletic and healthy, and he seemed fairly normal even 10 years after he went into the cocktails. But I've seen others, you know, just wilt very, very quickly, you know, once they started taking AZT, even with the supportive drugs that they would give them.
You know, that's assuming if that was a true story.
Exactly. I mean, who knows, you know? I mean, at this point, you can't trust any of this stuff. But, you know, I would just say that Well, it goes right into the question of, the pollution of a false historical narrative that we've been discussing so often over the last shows, how this makes impotent, the citizen, how it makes us vulnerable, how we feel like we need more government, and the medical crisis that's occurring now with autism and Crohn's disease and I mean, even HIV and all of the rise in the environmentally induced cancers, they're all basically coming about deliberately, in my opinion. The idea that the oligarchs would not know what the effects of the toxicity in the environment are going to be is preposterous. You see, Tim, to me, this is all very clear. It's part of the Brave New World. Huxley talks about, the Delta class and the Epsilon, and the quote about how it's by diet and injection.
There's Bertrand Russell, yeah, right.
Yeah, Russell's quote about diet and injection, the toxicity, that's really what's going to bring about, the kind of dictatorship that these people have in mind. And so the citizen just has to look at this kind of narrative and ask the question of, well, what is it designed to do as far as mind control and also of the creation of self-destructive behavior? I mean, they toxify you to the point where you get a cancer. Now is the right step to take, their toxic chemicals,
Well, yeah, what it
chemotherapy.
is someone gets a diagnosis like that, and they're standing there in nothing but a smock, and the doctor's there in his white coat, and he's giving you a death sentence. You're completely open. You're very vulnerable, and you're open to suggestion at that point, and you're terrorized. That's how the system's designed to do it, and you're given these are your choices. They say things like, you come down with some cancer. Well, it's the HPV virus you contracted 50 years ago. You know that, doctor? No, but well, you don't know that. That's ridiculous. You don't know. I mean, there's 50 years of life, and what else did I do in that 50 years that might have contributed to this condition now? These things. But they just say they throw these things out there as if they know them as fact, and they obviously don't, because it just doesn't stand the scrutiny of logic. Some of the things they claim, like, I don't know, it's like giving vaccines to a newborn baby, giving hepatitis B
For
shot to a
sexually
baby.
transmitted diseases.
Yeah, I mean, once a doctor recommends you do that, you can listen to him when it comes to cancer. I mean, it's absurd. Obviously, why they were talking about sex was going to get into the heterosexual community, because they had to put the fear into the wider population, the straight population, the normal population, to advance another agenda. And behind AIDS was also a broader cultural agenda of promoting more sexual degenerate behavior.
Right,
This was,
absolutely.
age education as a pretext to teach kids these things. You gave a beginning of this show, you talked you gave a warning. This may not be appropriate, if you have kids, you're in the car or something listening to this, and you have kids, because some of the things we're going to talk about. Well, that's funny, because that's what AIDS was kind of like, was doing. It was an invitation, a way to introduce topics that are no way appropriate for children to listen to, but they put the fear of AIDS into parents, and the parents became open to that or more accepting of it. And this was written up in, this is in Nancy Banks's book, on AIDS, Opium, and Empire. And that's a holistic study of what this all means. It's all part of high finance control and depopulation. Oligarchs control of the world. But she cited a 1989 National Research Council study revealed the hidden agenda behind AIDS. It was the Rockefeller Foundation and Russell Sage Foundation and U.S. Public Health Service funded study, AIDS, sex, and intravenous drug use. Basically, what it revealed was social engineering. It stated the devastating effect of an epidemic on a community can evoke strong political and social responses, the committee noted. An epidemic necessitates the rapid mobilization of the community to counter the spread of the illness or death. This is more or less kind of a shock doctrine, or more like so this is like a new we need a new Pearl Harbor, right? It states The eighth, ideally, health promotion messages should heighten an individual's perception of threat, thus modulating a level of fear. This is the type of language that's in this. So what they were doing was the report itself. Here's what the report says. What is not yet known is how to introduce fear in the right way in a particular message intended for a particular audience. Acquiring that knowledge will require planned variations of AIDS education programs that are carefully executed and then carefully evaluated. The report went on to expose how to attack societal moral values related to speaking and writing about sexuality in explicit terms. Again, they were advocating a direct attack on our children when they stated, despite recent indications of greatly increased tolerance for sexual explicitness in the media, thank you, authoritarian personality, in literature, their reluctance remains strong in much of the population. It is particularly strong in the instance that the education of children and adolescents is involved. So what you have there is AIDS, the fear of AIDS, the fact that you can get it at one time sexual experience, you can get AIDS, particularly through a heterosexual experience, became the pretext for some of these graphic sex ed programs being instituted. And, you know, this was the 1980s, and really sex ed wasn't implemented until, I think, the early 70s, under the pretext of reducing teenage pregnancy. Of course, it went up after they implemented these programs. Again, these programs weren't designed to inhibit sexual behavior. They were meant to promote it. They took the responsibility of sexual education away from the family, the children, the family and church, where it should be, and put it in these public schools, which had long since been captured institutions. And this the malevolence is clear. We also have to put this in the context of the 1969 Burleson Jaffe memo, where Planned Parenthood was commissioned by the U.S. government to develop ways to promote sexual, free love and sexual degeneracy for the purposes of depopulation and promoting things like homosexuality by promoting divorce, family breakup. And so you can't take that out of that context. This was, again, the AIDS was an excuse to just further the next stage in furthering, the sexual revolution, promoting sexual degenerate behavior among younger and younger members of the population.
Absolutely. I mean, well said. It's sort of like Clinton Lewinsky. You know, you have the scandal or you have the epidemic, and now, look, we can discuss these issues. And now we need to discuss the issues because, you see, the whole reason why the bathhouse culture exploded with the AIDS zombie that was going to eat the middle class is because we didn't have the right sex education for kids. And so we're going to fix that now. And again, I want to counsel parents that this is not children's material, but they actually started to discuss homosexual acts in sex ed in the late 80s, mm-hmm. right? Now, this was done as part of this education process, supposedly to slow down the epidemic, right, through more knowledge. But the fact is, this was just a way to insert an opportunity to discuss these things, because they knew that by discussing them, they could normalize them. So then you suddenly had charming acts such as rimming and fisting now being, you know, discussed openly as part of sex education for high school students. So at this point, you're pretty much Sodom and Gomorrah, you know, where you're literally, you know, just it's a debasement plus that you've entered into. And this is becoming the education that you're giving young people. And, you know, it has just gone forward now, you know, where you have the all gender bathrooms and mm-hmm. elementary schools, and you've got basically the GBTL alphabet soup sexuality being part of sensitivity training for children, you know, younger and younger age. Look, this is complete insanity.
If I were to walk into a park, a playground, and broach these topics while wearing a trench coat and holding a sticky lollipop to kids,
Yeah.
I'd be run out of there if not murdered by the parents.
Well, hopefully.
Put me in a school where I'm called a teacher or guidance counselor or health specialist or school nurse, whatever, and talk about these things. And I guess I'm a public official at that point, and I'm I'm due respect because I'm in a position of authority, I suppose.
Well, you're promoting multiculturalism.
Yeah, so I guess that this is again a testimony to mind control. The fact that people would tolerate such things, parents would tolerate such things.
Yeah, well, the parents have been broken down. I mean, remember, the parents have just come through the meat grinder. World War II, duck and cover, nuclear threat,
But they don't talk to each other because they all live in an integrated neighborhood where they're,
the destruction of the ethnic community. I mean, it's just so sad that the vast aspects, the all of the different things that were done to destroy the European communities in America can't be understood by the population. It's just catastrophic to our thinking that we can't look at all these elements as deliberate. This was not, history unfolding. This was organized. Read the Authoritarian Personality. Read Chapter 23. Look at MK Ultra, the documentation on the sort of experiments they were doing then. You can see that they were organizing themselves to shatter culture, to atomize it, to break it down into individuals. And all of the things that occurred are just slowly moving us toward basically dissociation, where we are as unemotional about the people next to us as a character in Brave New World, where Huxley, the Epsilon and Delta classes basically just see one another as atoms in a world that has no connection to anything. So this is what has happened to us, and all of these things. And that's why, you mentioned we could talk about AIDS this week, and I thought it was a really good idea because it really plugs into the schematic. The schematic that we're building out is the nature and the different programs that were used to shatter us, to atomize our families, our ethnicity, ourselves. Because ultimately it gets down to even yourself, is your soul starts getting separated from you when they keep the atomization going. And there's no sense of community. It's one thing I really do hope that the people that listen to us develop and see how they need to do this, is that our sense of community and brotherhood and ethnic connection. I mean, these and the love of one another that will create the energy to defend ourselves, because the attack is just relentless, and they are just determined to wipe us out. And all of the different things that are going on now culturally are all, they're all based upon these prior attacks. And AIDS was just, in my opinion, was just, I don't know if it was designed originally. I think this is far-fetched, but I think they certainly, once you started having the zombie-like, symptoms in the in coming out of the gay bathhouse culture, they seized upon that as an opportunity to basically create more need for scientism and government and just more trauma in the part of the population. And they're just moving us, step by step closer to a brave new world. And of course, with the AIDS epidemic came the advent of the really debased sex education, because now they had this crisis they had to address. It was the same thing, Tim, as like with the toxic chemicals. They couldn't give AZT to a cancer victim because it was too toxic, it would kill them. But AIDS fast-tracked everything. Do you remember that expression, fast track?
Yeah, like 17 weeks, not 17 months, not 17
Right. If
years.
you show
17
that
weeks, they thought that.
they had gotten the population so frightened by the the disco zombie eating the middle class, that they accepted a complete removal of all of the processes by which a chemical could be introduced. You know, they were just saying, look, if you can show it's going to slow the AIDS down, we'll just take it. And so AZT, which was a known killer, became like the drug of choice. It just shows that this was not, you know, there was nothing, no defense of the citizen was going on. It was just the oligarchs trying to see how much damage they could do.
Yeah, was it Larry Kramer who was agitating?
Yeah.
AZ, I remember, yeah. Basically, they became like promoters of Big Pharma. Give us the miracle drug, give us the miracle drug.
Right.
So we can continue, you know, taking dozens of drugs and having hundreds of sex partners a year, find us a cure for this. But the cure would be altering your lifestyle, living a more moral, healthier lifestyle. You know, but the bigger picture here, really, is if you look at the why we kind of talked about earlier, is why doctors wouldn't notice something so obvious is that, you know, the conditions they were seeing in the emergency rooms and the hospitals where people would collapse the immune system was they were living a wild, you know, unhealthy lifestyle with drugs, sex, and they just simply worn out their immune system. Is you have to look at the medical system itself, and doctors themselves have been trained as professional pill pushers largely for Big Pharma. That's how the medical industry is structured now, particularly since the 1970s. But this is, goes back to the creation of what we know as modern medicine or Western medicine. Western, you know, it's kind of funny because I was reading Liam Schiff's book, Official Stories. He's a whole chapter on AIDS. And he wrote, modern medicine pretty much developed out of war. You know, they're good at, you know, patching people back together again when they've been blown up, their broken bones and these things, but they're very bad with chronic illnesses. You know, they just don't know how to deal with that. They don't cope with naturopath or homeopathic solutions. They don't take a holistic approach to the human body. But it grows out of a war system. And when you look at the medical system as sort of a yet another wealth extraction system, same way we look at banking and finance and even entertainment. And you have to take a systems analysis approach to these things and don't look at AIDS or medicine as a node all by itself. These things are all connected. It's connected into the world of finance, into the world of banking and central banking and warfare, and mind control through the media and these things. And this is why this narrative, although if you just take a quick critical analysis of the evidence and reason, you can see this is all nonsense. Nevertheless, the mainstream media, the news, Time Magazine, the CDC, Center for Disease Creation, as some people call it, we're just spewing this line when it's so obvious, because we're dealing with a system here. And it dates all the way back, I mean, it dates centuries back, perhaps as far as the Opium Wars and British East India Company and these things. This is a worldview these people have, a vision, a way they have of organizing the world, and it's all about exploitation. Whether it's, opiating the Chinese masses so they can easily... reverse the balance of payments with China, get the tea, you know, or softening up China late for industrialization a century later. This is the type of time horizons that these people think of. That's why we when you look at like the Vietnam War and the heroin that came in from the Vietnam War, and the trauma that it imposed on. It created an American society, the financial strain it put on American society, leading to the collapse of the Bretton Woods system and the collapse of the remainder of the gold standard, the stagnation of wages, and the macroeconomic environment that led to the deindustrialization of the United States since the 1970s. This also factors into this plan to also to gradually industrialize China in wake of Mao's death in 1976. And we kind of see it all coming into play or into fruition now. Importation of drugs in the 80s, out of the dirty wars in Central America, crack cocaine, and this feeds the gangs in LA. This also feeds men into the prison industrial complex. At the same time, the drug money, the hundreds of billions of dollars, if not trillions, that are earned in the international drug trade, which end up in the coffers of Wall Street and these corporations, which concentrate wealth, collectivize and corporatize American society and this huge wealth concentration. If you look at companies like Walmart or Tyson's Food or some of these corporations that have profited or been able to, were capitalized allegedly by you know, drug money through Arkansas and these things, how it relates to sort of the decline of American life in middle America, decline of Main Street America, and the rise of Wall Street. This is Catherine Austin Fitz writes of the tapeworm economy, where the system is designed to sort of rot the system inside out in order to maximize short-term profits. To what end? Who knows? But it's a whole list. We kind of, you see the wider system at play here. There's a certain logic to it, and I guess maybe I'm inferring too much, I'm projecting too much, but if I can see the business model here, and I'm not the brightest person in the world, I'm sure there's some much more brilliant, albeit sociopathic, MBAs out there working for the oligarchs, you know, who saw how this would work, and it has worked out that way.
Yeah, well, I don't think there is anyone out there more brilliant than you are, Tim, but there are certainly people out there that are more psychopathic. And I would say that the business model that you're talking about is just part of the whole system. In other words, I disagree with people who say that money is the end goal here. It's power. It's basically control over mankind. And yeah, by all of the hundreds and billions of dollars, trillions of money that goes out of the hands of the public into the people who control the drug trade, it's just a way of keeping the overall population poorer, more beaten down. And the drugs are run by, you know, the Masonic crypto control structure. They end up with all the money. You don't see it. I mean, the drug, you know, agent on the street, you know, is like some inner city youth. I mean, he's hated, you know, hunted down by the police. But that's not the person who's actually starting the process by which the drugs come into the community and overseeing it. You know, it's really the bringing up Palmerston as, you know, he was the head Freemason in the Orient. He's the one who actually ran the gunboats. This is a fact that people should mm-hmm. should recognize when you look at all the other Masonic, you know, aspects of cultural destruction, is that Palmerston was, he was the head Freemason of the Orient. This is before he became Prime Minister of Britain. And he's the one who was actually in charge of the gunboats who were, you know, were slaughtering the coolies or trying to resist the drug addiction. And so this shows who's controlling the drugs. And when you look today at our opium epidemic in the United States, I mean, it's just beyond catastrophe, you know, what's occurring. The opium addiction and opium deaths are just skyrocketing. I was reading an article the other day that was indicating that they had detected heroin, or OxyContin, which basically is synthetic heroin, in the mussels growing in waters around Seattle and that Puget Sound, and that in some cases the mussels tested high enough to be able to be arrested.
Jeez.
And it's a real story.
Yeah, this would be the Sackler family who produced.
Yeah, exactly. The Sacklers, you know, who are related back to the Palmerstons and all of the Masonic, you know, this business about getting, you know, what a good idea it is to get the population to take these debilitating drugs. And so, you know, bringing it back to AIDS, I mean, then now they have AZT. Just think of what they've been able to do with people that they can claim are testing positive for HIV.
Oh, look at people who go to jail for assault because they spread HIV, right?
Yeah.
The people who are in jail based on the junk. Some people have been released now based on because of the junk science.
Thank heavens. Yeah. Because you see, the big problem with the junk science is one of the problems with it is that it doesn't let the victim have the good answer as to what he's got to do, which is to stop the lifestyle.
Yeah.
Change your lifestyle. You have to look at what's the toxicity of your lifestyle, of the microbe, right? All these sex partners.
Actually, it's illegal in California to advise that.
I know.
Reparative therapy, I think, is the term where they that's illegal.
But see, this is how bad it's gotten, yeah, where the truth that will actually heal is illegal to mention. Because you see, the thing you have to remember about like the paupers, it's just, you know, this is really sad stuff, because the paupers were promoted just incredibly. I mean, you look at some of the advertisements in San Francisco and the
William
early.
Burr, I think William Burroughs was the company, I think.
Yeah. But so they
not
were.
William Burroughs. Burroughs, Welcome. William Burroughs,
yes.
The writer. Burroughs, Welcome. Yeah.
I'm trying to look this up right now. Anyway, the but the point is the big one of the big aspects of amyl nitrate is its ability to deaden pain in the anus.
Jeez.
I'm sorry to be so graphic, but do you see my point here?
Why would you do that if it?
Well, you see the drug is preventing the information from the body.
Yes.
To getting to the mind that what you're doing is wrong, you see.
The pain
and
does
so,
serve a function, yes.
Exactly.
It's
and so obviously this drug has to be removed, right? It has to be removed from the environment. But instead, they tried to exonerate it. Even the Center for Disease Control did this really bogus study, you know, which was later just laughed at, that, well, we really can't be sure that amyl nitrate has some kind of toxicity for the immune system. My God. So we have a system here, folks, whereby the authorities are corrupt and malevolent. And so we need to learn to think clearly. And here, you know, I think this is a good example. You know, this is like I always talk about, you know, you've got to have the courage to introduce ideas. If we're going to have any chance to keep the brave new world, the technological slave state from onsetting, we've really got to at least have the courage to bring these subjects up. And so here's one that, you know, it's a really good one to get into is to just say, look, HIV, that whole thing was related to lifestyle. The lifestyle came about from propaganda, and these poor people were victims of the propaganda. They lost their moral bearings, and then they ended up sick. But we have to not assume that just because, you know, someone with a white coat or someone who has access to the New York Times headline committee says that a disease is occurring, that in fact, you know, such a thing is actually happening. I'm very happy. Earlier this week, I was able to get into a shouting match with a physician. I think, you know, and I just accused him of evil. I said, you know, you've really basically breached the Hippocratic Oath. He's an oncologist, and I was trying to get him to admit that chemotherapy was bogus. And I just had, you know, some really silly, well, not silly, but just some very core basic statistics. And he wasn't aware of anything. And I said, you know, this shows that you don't know it, but you're malevolent. You are evil because you're just buying the information that's being given to you, and you have no evidence to back any of this stuff up. You know, when I was listening to Kerry Mulis, the Nobel laureate, you know, and he was talking about that it's just incredible that when he would go out into the community, to the research community, and say, well, give me the citation about the causality between HIV and AIDS, and it wasn't there. And he described a kind of like mental zombie control over these people, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to stop looking at the guys in the white coats as anything other than pill pushers. I mean, this is, I hate to say it, Tim, I know, you know, and everyone needs to go for, you know, I'm not giving medical advice here. I'm just, this is political opinion. I think that the whole, physician structure is corrupt. I think the Hippocratic Oath has completely been breached. Doctors are just pill pushers at this point. No one is really standing up for the interests of their, you know, of the citizens here, right? And so it's up for the citizen. We are in uncharted territory. We can't trust any of these things that they're trying to hoist on us. We can't trust the vaccines. We can't trust the chemotherapy, the radiation. We can't even trust the idea that a disease exists. I mean, you were talking about the Zika virus.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, again, here you have really extraordinary environmental sort of causality potentials that haven't been, you know, fully fleshed out. and the public is being led down a path where hopefully, you know, they're hopefully not, but I mean, where they could end up like taking another vaccination.
Yeah.
Right.
And then look at
like the state of California. You want to attend the public school. Your kid has to have 70 vaccinations. Right. Well, I'm sorry, but this just is the courage has to come up the parent. You just have to say, you know, I just don't see the science in back of this. I know in some cases there is malevolence, and so I'm opting out. I'm going to protect my kid. And I just would think that's what I would, you know, if there is people out there listening to this and you've got someone who's involved in the gay lifestyle, you know, here's the, you know, have them listen to the show and say, what do you think? You know, we're saying really as clearly as we can that the toxicity of the lifestyle has to be the first thing you consider and the first thing you change, not the last.
Yeah.
You don't, I'm going to take AZT. Look, once you start taking these drugs, once you go to chemo, you know, who knows what's left of your body. Try being healthy first. Try learning, you know, the things you have to do to have the strongest immune system first. Do that first. Use your own research first. Do this now. Don't go to the white coat guys and say, well, where are the drugs?
Yeah, yeah. And one thing I've noticed is whenever I often when I'm talking about something like HIV/AIDS, it's a hoax, or you know, the problems with the official narrative, the reaction I often get is people immediately ridicule, because to suggest that the authorities, the men in white coats, the government cannot be trusted, it's so disorienting a lot of people. It's also it ruffles their feathers, because it suggests to them that they're going to have to do more work. They figure they're already paid for these experts. I have health insurance, and I'm already on drugs. I already gave my kids these vaccines, and I've already had my kid, you know, take some sort of psychotropic drug for his, because he can't study, can't concentrate. And so it's frightening to people, because it means they have to start thinking again. And that's very difficult. But the level of mind control really is astonishing, and how this is done. And again, it's in Nancy Banks' book. She talks about that in her The Drugging of America. And she writes, by controlling the history departments of the major universities through their endowments and the selection of appropriately inclined department chairs, elite families have managed to keep this ignominious history from a general discussion. By controlling the mainstream media and showing a steady stream of young African-American and Hispanic males arrested for street-level drug dealing, they have been able to maintain their mask of respectability. Many street-level drug pushers can hardly read a newspaper. To think that they would be in charge of a worldwide business, establish protection and distribution networks, pay off police departments, politicians, and judges, run international covert operations with coordinated logistical support from the Pentagon and the FAA, as well as assorted foreign clandestine services operating from businesses including airlines and insurance firms, as well as launder the proceeds of at least 6% of the global economy, is ludicrous.
It is ludicrous. Yeah. What a great description. Yeah, ludicrous.
So, but this is all covered up, because really the meta criminals, the oligarchs who are actually running this thing, they've successfully, again, controlled the narrative, because they have the resources to control the mass media, which most people, you know, depend on for their understanding of the world. So,
yeah, you know, it's interesting you bring up the you know, the kind of priesthood you know, relationship that a lot of people have. Like, one thing I've been fascinated by is, like, I just have lots of people I know that have cancer. Everyone around me has it, just about, that doesn't live, you know, like a kind of an organic lifestyle. So many people. I'm getting on, you know, in years, and so, like, my social circle, small as it is starting to drop, you know, like, mm-hmm. but so they get cancer. And none of them, you know, would have tried alternative medicine, right? They all opt eventually for, you know, the medical professionals at MD Anderson, you know, the oncology specialists in Texas, or, you know, just. But what's fascinating, my point, is that every one of them says, you know, I've got the very best guy. I've got the very best department. It's like they've got some gizmo whiz bang. I mean, Dr. Gizmo Berg is the best doctor in the world. And he's the one who's, I mean, it's like, and then the other guy goes, no, no, I've got, you know, Professor, Chemostein, and he's the very best, you know. I mean, but it's like they all have this kind of slavish, acolyte, just sort of worshiping relationship. It's like the sicker they get, the more they look at their physician as almost like divinity, mm-hmm. you know? And it's really sad to see because it's so obvious. You can see what's going on. It's their fear of dying is just short-circuited the thinking ability, right? And so they just want to believe in God at this point. And that by that, I mean the godlike physician. And so they create, you know, they think that the one that they have is this unique genius that knows how to cure everybody. When, I mean, in fact, they're all dying and it's just tragic to watch, but they believe it. And so this is, you know, this is my real time experience of this divinity worship that interferes with, you know, the right approach, which is just to say, show me the facts. I'm going to use my own judgment here. And, you know, because what happens now, it's really amazing, is that if you come in and you get, you know, you have a cancer, I mean, you're scheduled for chemo.
Yep.
There isn't any kind of like, well, here's some research and you make a decision. It's just like, well, we detected cancer and here's your, you'll be Thursday, you'll start your chemo. Mm-hmm. It's just automatic. There is just an absolutely automatic process to take you into radiation, chemo, and the other crap. You know, there's no discussion with you. My friend had lymphoma. He's dead, sadly. And so, you know, he had radiation and chemo. And afterwards, when he was going to stay at my house because he doesn't really have any family, we're really going to let him stay with us while he was trying to recover. He's 6'3" and he weighed 133 pounds after the radiation. And so he gets to our house and I said, Steve, what did they tell you about nutrition? You know, like obviously we've got to build up the old immune system here.
Yeah.
And he said, well, they said to be sure to eat.
But you can't because you're throwing up all the time.
Well, yeah, but be sure to eat. It's like, well, that's good. Like that's ice cream and Budweiser beer.
Big Mac.
Yeah. And I mean, here you are when your immune system is challenged to the greatest degree possible and your nutritional, you know, your input, which was all you have to really build up your immune system, they use one word, eat. So
that's their understanding. And I would say, yeah, last week I was out on the deck talking with a friend of mine, and we were talking about some of these things and people with cancer. And we were going on some of these things, and he was... I was talking, you have to understand this whole thing. You have to sort of take a holistic approach to these things because everything really is connected, kind of like what I said earlier. And so there's no way to, you know, reduce it down to a bumper sticker in a political campaign or anything. But we were just observing back people who are ill, and it's just kind of a baby boom phenomenon as you know, you all have entered the later years, is they're all addicted. They're all hypochondriacs, addicted to the doctors and these things. They're all like getting pills, they're all on drugs, blood thinners, painkillers, this, that. And I was talking about his father lived into his mid-80s, and I said, when he was in his 60s and 70s, did he ever go see a doctor? He said, no, he was healthy, he just never thought of going to a doctor, until he started getting old and developed his problems, which were, you know, into his mid-80s. So he just, as he got old, it wasn't assumed, because you're old, you had to go see a doctor, and got poked, prodded, and drugged. And that's changed. And now, maybe this is a function of Medicare and insurance and these things. There's nothing, the whole insurance industry is designed to do this to us, make it outrageously expensive at the same time, make everyone else pay for it so everyone uses it, as opposed to being out of pocket. You know, people be more frugal with it, more responsible. But this is older people just didn't reflexively go to the doctor. And
yeah.
Now they do, you know.
Well, that's right. You know, you take responsibility for your own health and amazing things happen. I'm a good example, Tim. Let me give you a little. Okay, so I like to play tennis. I've played it my whole life, but I'm not a great player. I'm kind of a crappy player because I don't have the right kind of coordination, basically, you know, for it. So there are, you know, I enjoy it. I've always played it, but there's always been really tons of people much better than me.
Mm-hmm.
So they have these age divisions, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they have, like, you know, the 65 and the 70s, right? And suddenly I'm looking at my competition. I'm going, wait a second. They're all dead. I may be able to start winning just because they're not no longer in existence. You see?
Yeah.
So this is a really good example of, you know, I'm really, you know, you don't notice it because it's just your own little life and you walk around inside it and, you know, how do you get perspective? But I'm noticing that my physical abilities are becoming unusual. They weren't like 20 years ago. They certainly weren't 50 years ago. But now I'm going, you know, I'm a lot faster. I'm a, like, stronger. I'm just a healthier, younger kind of body than a lot of these other guys, the ones that aren't dead yet.
Yeah.
And I think it's completely because I married a woman who was basically a nutritionist, right? Who just was, you know, 40 years ago into eating, make sure you'd eat, like, you know, healthy food, and she wouldn't let any crap in the house. And I when you get married, you have to make adjustments. And I was just humoring her. I had no idea this was, like, actually there was some value. But over time, it has appeared to me, I go, you know, we're really, like, not aging like all these other people are, you know, and it's just, it's a real, like, if you saw us, you'd think, well, they look pretty, you know, pretty spry. I mean, look, he can still play his crappy tennis. And I'm telling you, by the time I'm 80, at the current pace, I'll be one of the best players in the world.
Now,
there'll be no one left.
That's a testament to the value of, like, prepared meals, home-cooked
yeah.
meals. But the whole system's designed, like, with the breakup of family, two-income families, no
yeah.
wife at home to do these. Obviously, this is something that women are particularly good at, is maintenance of their husband's health.
Yeah.
Make them eat right. Of course, this is a very sexist statement I'm making, but of course, I'm a sexist, so I don't care. But the idea that this was lost and it's not or devalued to the point where, you know, domestic the woman taking care of the domestic side and maintaining a home is somehow being less than out there working. Well, this is the cost of it. And one of the things is the obesity crisis, which is very high among, like, lesbian women because they don't know how to cook. They weren't. And
oh, you know, that's really interesting.
The lost art of cooking, where this has caused an explosion yeah. in the obesity crisis, which is downstream profits for the medical industrial complex. So,
and look at how skinny the gay guys are.
Yeah.
I mean, I think we're probably in a, you know, reaching far into speculation, but I just think that I think single males, you know, and also particularly like the lesbians as a class, that just my, you know, this is just my observation. They have crap diets and they look like hell.
Yeah.
They look like pre-diabetic typically. A lot of the lesbians that I've seen and males, gay and straight, that live alone just tend to, you know, I mean, their health just disintegrates, you
well,
know.
If you watch movies and Hollywood and TV, it's lesbian women are always beautiful, and gay men are always, they're the only ones that have normal relationships, and they're the only healthy ones. It's the married people who are fat, dumb, and burdened with children.
Yeah, well, there you have it. I mean, you know, the media is an absolute 100% weapon, and AIDS got swept up in it. You know, I think the tragic events of the cancer outbreak was weaponized, and we ended up with the gay zombie from the disco who was going to eat the middle class. You know, that was just another, you know, hammer to the soul of the baby boomer. And I mean, now it actually is sort of preposterous. I don't know how they can even maintain it any longer as kind of a straight concept, because if it was a virus that was capable of, like, spreading, it would have spread, right? I mean, it would have been in the heterosexual community. How many people in like your local high school actually have AIDS that can be verified, you know, to some extent?
Mm-hmm.
None. It just isn't there, you know? So it was, you know, so now it requires an explanation. Well, why did they promote it as, like, a terrorist reality to all of the, you know, all of the baby boomers in the 80s? Well, I think it's the same thing that it's just been going on with everything. It was just part of the media, you know. It's like, don't let your kids watch zombie movies, and don't read the headlines about the gay disco zombie.
Yeah, and again, just to make sure they can further poison or drug America, and also slide it deeper into degeneracy. So, okay, Joe, I think we covered it.
Tim, I will talk to you soon, I hope.
Yeah,
thank you.
Talk soon. Good night, then.
Okay, buddy. Bye-bye.
Bye.